Parents be warned, this message may contain content which is unsuitable for younger listeners. Your discretion is advised.
This week we will be finishing the narrative for the Book of Ruth. This is our third week in the book, and we'll be discussing the last two chapters, 3 and 4. If you haven't listened to previous messages on Ruth, published in the last 2 weeks, or if you haven't listened to the message Leave Her at Marriage, published February 12th of 2017, it would probably be best for you to listen to those first, because we will be building on previously established narratives and principles. Herein, the overarching problem in the Book of Ruth will be solved. Previously, we discussed the dramatic tensions in Ruth's story, primarily that she was a widow who needed a husband to give her a son who could be the heir to her deceased husband Maclon's line. And last week, we introduced Boaz, a redeemer of Ruth's family, who seemed like good potential to solve that problem. So this week, Ruth will find a husband, but how she does this will be a far cry from both modern Christian ideas and secular ideas about marriage. And this will give us cause to contemplate what the Bible says about marriage and how social norms have changed over time. So then, the passage is Ruth chapters 3 and 4, and if you haven't read them yet, I recommend that you pause and read them now. In the opening of chapter 3, Naomi decided that it was high time for Ruth to get a husband. It seemed clear enough, I think, to everyone involved that Boaz was a good option. As a family redeemer, it would be his responsibility. As a man of wealth, he could afford to care for Ruth, and it seemed evident enough that he liked having her around. It had been 2 months, and Boaz had not made a move, so Naomi decided it was time for Ruth to make herself a little more forward. And so Naomi told Ruth her plan for reeling this man in. Boaz and his men would be out winnowing grain at the threshing floor. The threshing floor would be a large flat area in an elevated place where the wind would blow through. Threshing was the process of removing the chaff, that is, the hard and edible shell, from the outside of the grain. In an operation like Boaz's, it would have been done by using animals to pull a large stone wheel over the grain. The weight of the wheel would crack the chaff, separating it from the grain, and then the grain would be winnowed. In the winnowing process, the grain, mixed with the shells from the threshing process, would be thrown into the air and the wind would blow the chaff away. The grain, which was more dense, would fall back to the threshing floor. So, to make a long description short, they were processing the harvested barley to make it edible, but they couldn't just do it where they had grown it. The barley had to be winnowed at the threshing floor. To make the process more efficient, Boaz and his men would have gone to the threshing floor to stay for the night. That way, everyone wouldn't have to waste time walking back and forth in town. Naomi told Ruth to bathe and anoint herself and to put on her cloak, to get dolled up, if you will, and to go to where Boaz was. But Ruth was not to make herself known at first. If Boaz saw her at the threshing floor, he might have sent her home. Instead, Naomi urged Ruth to wait until all the work was done and Boaz had had supper, and then to take note of where he was sleeping. Likely there were several or many men sleeping out at the threshing floor. So if Ruth hadn't been there at daylight to observe where everyone lied down, then she wouldn't have been able to find Boaz in the dark. Then, once the men were sleeping, Ruth was to sneak up to Boaz, uncover his feet, and lie down with him. And to that I ask, why at his feet? The passage doesn't really say, so we would have to speculate to come up with an answer. Perhaps uncovering one's feet, for whatever reason, was an idiomatic way of simply saying to uncover a person in general. Some have suggested that this is a customary way for a widow to propose a lever at marriage, but that seems doubtful because it's highly specific and not mentioned anywhere else in Scripture. Perhaps Ruth was to lay down at Boaz's feet as a sign of submission. Maybe being under the feet was a symbol of Boaz taking possession of a thing. Or maybe she was simply supposed to lie at the feet so as to not be altogether too forward by cuddling right up into his arms. But whatever the reason, this evidently was an invitation to Boaz that he should take Ruth as his bride right then and there. And when I say take, I mean sexually in this context. Naomi may have feared that Boaz would reject Ruth in a daytime discussion, but when a woman is readily available after a long day of working at the threshing floor, after a little eating and drinking and in the fog of sleep, Boaz might have been more inclined to take the more instinctual and less rational option. And if Boaz took that bait, he'd be stuck with Ruth whether he liked it after the fact or not. Now, we should not compare this at all to a case of some kind of sexual immorality. Naomi's advice presumably was given with the law in mind. If Naomi believed that Boaz was the next of kin, then he had both a right and a duty to Ruth to take her as a bride. And if he had been the next of kin, there wouldn't be any formality that Boaz needed to go through to do that. Ruth could give herself, and Boaz could take her, and that would be that. So Ruth did as she had been instructed. She found Boaz at the threshing floor, he had dinner, he laid down, and Ruth went to lay down with him. At midnight, Boaz was startled to find her there, and in the dark he didn't know who she was. But he was greeted with a very pleasant surprise. Ruth, and he was her redeemer. She asked Boaz to spread his wings over her. Those wings would be the corners of his cloak. In those days, cloth was difficult to make and expensive, so people didn't have many sets of clothes and blankets and pillows like we have today. Most people would have had one long flowing outer garment made from a large piece of cloth. In that day, it was worn like we might wear a coat, but at night it was used as a blanket. So in essence, Ruth asked him to share some covers. If he did, he would be taking her in as a wife, sealing the deal. Boaz blessed Ruth for having chosen to do her duty rather than chasing men her own age. Now, we don't know how old Ruth was, but she wasn't very old. 14 would have been a normal marrying age at the time, and if she had not been married long before her husband Machlon died and she followed Naomi to Judah, she might have still been a teenager. Otherwise, if she had married at the ripe old age of 18, just after Elimelech arrived in Moab and these events occurred a full 10 years later, Ruth would have been 28. I have serious doubts that she would have been older than that. But even that age seems very unlikely because, well, for one thing, it would have meant that she married old, and it also would have meant that she had been married to Machlon for 10 years. If that had been the case, we would have expected her to give birth to a child. So I'd say the odds are quite good that she was in her late teens. Boaz, meanwhile, was a man of lands and workers, a family redeemer. He must have been in at least his 30s and could have been significantly older than that, particularly since he characterized himself as an older man. It is very reasonable for us to think that he might have been twice Ruth's age, or more. Of course, the Bible displays no concern for the age at which a woman marries or whether her husband is close to her age, and in general, no one else did either for all of history up until about the beginning of the 20th century with the advent of feminism. And that isn't because there was no record-keeping of people's ages either. Baby boys had to be circumcised at the tabernacle a week after they were born, and ancient Israel displayed a lot of effort in keeping accurate records of ancestry and such. So, for a boy at least, his birth date and age were likely known. Admittedly, whether anyone would remember a girl's birth date might have been a different matter, but regardless, the point was this. If a girl was pubescent and had reproductive capabilities, she was generally going to get married to someone, and the age was not a factor. Regardless, a bit of tension was suddenly thrown into the story in chapter 3, verse 12. Here we are in the story, seemingly at the threshold of Boaz taking Ruth as his bride and perfectly resolving the conflict, only to find that Ruth and Naomi had made a wrong assumption. Boaz was indeed a redeemer in the clan, but he was not the nearest relative of Ruth's. There was another potential redeemer of closer relation, and so the right to redeem Machlon's estate actually fell to him, not to Boaz. Boaz said that he would seek that man out in the morning, and that if the other redeemer was not willing to take Ruth, then he, Boaz, would do so himself. Ruth stayed with Boaz until morning, but got up to leave before anyone had noticed her. And it is a good thing that she did. I'm sure that nothing untoward happened between Ruth and Boaz, but a woman spending the night at the threshing floor with a group of men would be a very bad look. If it was found out, it could have been a scandal. Boaz, perhaps as a sign of his commitment, sent Ruth home with 6 measures, precise amount unknown, of barley. Ruth told Naomi what had happened, and Naomi assured her that the matter would be soon settled. We find that resolution in chapter 4. The ancient rhythm of agrarian life looked something like this. By night, the people generally stayed in a town. Towns had walls that kept wild animals and intruders out. When morning came, the gates would open, and people would stream out of the cramped cities and into the surrounding fields to tend crops and graze animals. For that reason, most anyone could be found passing through the city gate during the morning commute. As a high traffic and thus high visibility area, the city gate served as something like a courthouse. Anyone needing to conduct legal affairs would meet with the city's elders and resolve the matter when the other party passed by. And thus Boaz did. He waited by the gate, and when the Redeemer passed by, he stopped him. Boaz then found 10 elders of the city who also sat. This was sort of like calling a meeting of the city council or seating a jury or something. These men would ensure that the matter was settled in accordance with the law and would serve as witnesses to the resolution. Of note, 10 seems to be a magic number for such things. The lowest rank of judge, as prescribed in Exodus 19, ruled over 10 families, and each step up the judicial hierarchy ruled over 10 of the lower judicial circuits. Based on that and on some other passages like this one, later Jewish law would prescribe 10 men as the minimum number required to decide a case. That is not a requirement listed in the Bible, but it was Jewish tradition recorded in the Mishnah in the 3rd century after Christ. And a link to that information will be recorded in the library. Having brought together the elders, Boaz opened by framing the problem as a simple land exchange. There had been no heir apparent to Elimelech's land, so Naomi, acting as executor of her husband's estate, was to give it to the next of kin. The closest kinsman would have the right of first refusal. The other redeemer at first said that he would redeem the land, but the estate came with a catch. Whomever redeemed the land would also acquire Ruth with it, and the duty to father a child by her. Faced with that prospect, the second redeemer changed his mind. His reason, he said, for refusing Ruth was that this would impair his own inheritance. Exactly what he meant by that was unclear. Perhaps he had limited land to bequeath to his children, and was concerned that if in taking Ruth he fathered multiple children, that the inheritance of his children would be diminished by further division, and that this would be unfair to them. Alternatively, or additionally, he may not have wanted to devote the resources necessary to provide for Ruth and Machlon's heir. Doing so could have put him into a precarious financial situation which his estate could not afford. Whatever the specifics, he rejected the deal. Now, before we move on, it is helpful for us to contemplate the actual law that was in question. It is the law of Levirate marriage, found in Deuteronomy 25:5 through 10, which I will now read from the English Standard. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. And if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, "My husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me." Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him, and if he persists, saying, "I do not wish to take her," then the brother's wife shall go to him in the presence of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. And she shall answer and say, "So shall it be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house." And the name of his house shall be called in Israel, the house of him who had his sandal pulled off. So the requirement on the Redeemer was that he should take Ruth, father a child for her deceased husband Machlon, and then provide for them to build up the family. To fail to do this, though, was described in the law as a public disgrace. In failing that duty, the unwilling brother would suffer the unbearable public indignity of having a woman spit in his face and take his sandal. Then he'd be walking around all day with only one sandal on, so as to make himself a public mockery, and the shame of that would be carried for years to come. In fact, his house would be called the house of him who had his sandal pulled off, in scathing mockery. The house, a house established on the failure to perform the duty to his brother, one which left his lonely widow to suffer, would be much disgraced indeed. However, by the time of Ruth, it had been several hundred years since that law was penned, and evidently this had become more of a legal formality than any kind of public disgrace. My guess is that in Ruth's time, a man was not so much expected to take his brother's widow as he was expected to appear before the elders to perform a sandal-exchanging ceremony long since devoid of its actual meaning, so that the widow could be free to remarry. In fact, verse 7 describes that taking the sandal off and exchanging it had become more like a method to confirm a transaction. We have mentioned before the importance of such customs for validating a contract. Two people might talk back and forth about an idea and their interests in it without actually binding themselves to any commitment. Today we bind ourselves by signing our names on a contract or making a handshake. But there have been many different customs at different times. Abraham, for example, bound his servant by having him place his hand under his thigh, and we've seen plenty of self-maledictory oaths and even animal sacrifices used to ratify important commitments. In this case, though, everyone would accept that drawing off the sandal and handing it to the other party was enough to demonstrate that the Redeemer had relinquished any right he may have had to MacLone's estate. We note also that the passage itself describes this as, quote, the custom in former times, end quote. Ruth was written sometime far enough after the events in question that sandal handing had gone out of fashion and would not have been understood by the audience reading the story. I think we should take that as a sign of cultural decline in Israel after the age of the judges. During the rule of the judges, tumultuous as it was, the people at least maintained some ceremonial semblance of the laws. During the reign of the kings, the people must not have known the laws or even have been able to recognize the ceremonies that had been connected with them. This, I think, echoes a modern understanding of marriage. Ceremonial aspects are still lingering, but they are increasingly devoid of meaning and are vanishing. In verses 9 and 10, Boaz declared to everyone present that they were witnesses to this transaction and that he was now the owner of everything that had belonged to Elimelech's family, including Ruth. The elders agreed to this, and in verses 11 through 12, they gave a blessing. The blessing was made in the name of Jehovah that he should make Ruth like Rachel and Leah. Rachel and Leah are best known for having competed to have the most children, and those children became the heads of the tribes of Israel. It is interesting to note that Rachel is mentioned ahead of Leah here. Usually that is not the case, and it might be surprising since Leah, not Rachel, was the ancestral mother of the tribe of Judah, of which these people were a part. However, the people of Bethlehem may have had a special connection to Rachel since she had died and was buried nearby. So the first part of the blessing then was that Ruth should produce many children, as Leah and Rachel had done, and indeed, this is the best blessing that can be given to a woman. The second part of the blessing was that he should be a person of renown and that his house would be like the house of Perez. Perez was one of the sons of Judah and thus a prominent patron of the tribe, and he was likely noted here because he had also been a son born of a levirate marriage between Judah and Tamar in Genesis 38. We discussed them in a message titled Judah and Tamar Birth Control back on February 19th of 2017. And so in verse 13, Boaz took Ruth to be his wife. And I want to briefly emphasize that word took. It translates the Hebrew lakeich. It means to take or receive a thing, or even to capture a thing and carry it away. Some less than literal translations attempt to smooth this over for English ears by saying that Boaz married Ruth, but that is not what the passage says. The modern English conception of marrying someone carries a connotation of mutual consent from equal parties entering into a contractual agreement via some ceremony. That is not what the passage says. It says that he, the dominant party, took her, the passive party, in an unequal property arrangement. Ruth clearly was consenting in all of this, but it is evident that the crowd watching the legal transaction had no real concern for whether Ruth wanted a husband or which one she wanted. So far as I can tell, she wasn't even present while everyone was hammering out which man would be her husband. And, aside from the first Redeemer rejecting her with the exchange of a sandal, there was no ceremony involved. Ruth and Boaz didn't walk down an aisle and exchange vows and so forth. Boaz took her, and that was that. And as a happy consequence of this, Ruth's son, Obed, was born. The women of the town rejoiced at this, praising Jehovah for the blessing, that there should be a young man, a new redeemer of their family, who would provide for Ruth and Naomi in their old age. Naomi, having once been made bitter, was restored in sitting the child on her lap and becoming his nurse. Note that that word nurse does not imply that she was a literal wet nurse. The Hebrew in question has nothing to do with actual nursing. Rather, it describes a trusted person, a supporter, or even an adoptive parent. So evidently, this first son was given to Naomi to raise in the place of MacLone, while Ruth went on with Boaz to have a family of her own. The women called the child Obed, which means worshiping or serving. Perhaps this was to reflect that they worshipped God in celebration of his birth, or maybe that Obed would be one who served Naomi. And so the story of Ruth and Naomi closed with a happy ending, all conflicts resolved. We will reserve contemplation of the genealogy for another day.
Due to its great length, this message has been split in half for time's sake. You can listen to the continuation at eastjordan.church.